Hello and welcome to the Barton Legal Podcast. I'm Bill Barton, a solicitor who lives and breathes construction and engineering law. At Barton Legal, we help clients in the UK and around the world on everything from litigation and arbitration to drafting and negotiating contracts. And in this podcast, we unpack the latest legal trends and problems facing the industry, providing you with straight-talking insights to help break down these complex legal questions. So, let's get on with today's episode. I am very pleased today to be joined by Nick Emerson, the President of the Law Society of England and Wales, somebody I've known for a few years and is now in that exalted position where he is addressed as President, which must be quite a magnificent thing at that level. So, Nick, how are you?
I'm good, Bill. Thank you for inviting me to participate today.
Brilliant. Well, I'm very glad being able to get you on. You're a very busy man. So I'll kick straight off. So you went to Stokesley School in North Yorkshire, Stokesley, and then to Newcastle Uni. And I'm interested because there you studied East Asian Studies. And I just wondered, what was it and when that you realised you had an interest in Asia, and as we'll discover, in particular, Japan?
Yeah, as most of these things, Bill, it's completely by chance. So I was studying politics at Newcastle University to start with for my first year, and they had another department within the politics department that specialised in politics and East Asian studies. So it was a group of people who were very professional at what they did, and professors in Japan, Korea, and China, and they had their own separate BA course that nobody really had signed up to. So the Chinese bit filled during my first year, they managed to get people across to do that. Obviously, some people were interested in China from the start, but the Japan one was quite empty, and they were looking for people, and it was in the late 1980s, and I realized that whilst I wanted to be a lawyer ultimately, and I was very interested in politics, ultimately, wouldn't it be great if I could do something a bit different? So just on a whim, I asked to join the politics and East Asian degree. So I switched degrees at the end of my first year. And in particular, that allowed me to go for a year in Japan. So that extended my degree to 4 years, and I got a year in Japan. So yeah, a bit of chance and a bit of fate, really.
So a good sneaky early move for travel. So what was it like? What was it like in Japan then? I mean, just as a place.
Yeah, Japan then was just coming out of the peak of the bubble, although they probably didn't realise it at the time. They'd been through this enormous economic growth spurt since the war, where people really had buckled down and turned their economy around because they were completely devastated after the war. And you talk to some elderly people in Japan and they remember starvation as children. And so they really, really put their foot to the metal, if you like, and really sorted themselves out. And they were just at that time beginning to enjoy the spoils of that. And so people were exceptionally well off. The stock market was still doing okay. But since that time, really, until recently, actually, the stock market had been pretty stagnant and everything had been pretty stagnant. But it was kind of a post-industrial society, nice stagnant, and people were living good lives, and they were the second richest economy in the world, and now the third. But they still lived very high quality lives. So yes, it was a fascinating time to be there. There was a little bit of arrogance in some of the academic publications that were introduced at the time. So there was a guy called Carl von Wolfram wrote a book, and I think it was called The Theory of Being Japanese. And he, for example, put forward a proposal that the Japanese were unique and special and in all sorts of different ways. And so there was this kind of, not nationalism, because nationalism wasn't really alive then. And after the war, nationalism was not a very popular thing. But he certainly, there was certainly a pride that I think has mellowed over the years. And as you've seen China rise as well, you've seen them being very proud and then also mellowing. So it's just very interesting to see societies go through these transitions. So yeah, it was a great place to be and a lot of fun.
I've never been to Japan, but I'm very excited by the fact that I'm actually going in April for a week.
I'll be there as well, so I might catch up with you.
All right, the IPBA conference.
Yeah, I'm going to that.
All right, brilliant. There you go. But I've been to Korea now a few times because that's sort of more our sort of target area. And I've read a lot of South Korean history. And as you say, it's a really, really fascinating region, the dynamics between Korea, obviously it was a single country, and China and Japan, and the sort of the conflicts and the rest between those countries. It is a very interesting dynamic. And when I first went to Korea, so only, I don't know, 5 years ago, I had never realised that there was still quite a conflict between South Korea and Japan. I've only seen it over a few years, but you've seen Japan change. And has that been an interesting contrast, a country that you must know pretty well over 30 years compared with the UK?
Yeah, I think with Korea, obviously Korea was a colony of Japan up until the end of the Second World War. You know, there are some old, very old people in Korea who can only speak Japanese because that's all they learned at school. So there was a whole, you know, Japanification, if you like, of Korea. And when the Japanese kicked out at the end of the Second World War, you know, actually Korea was left in good shape. You know, there was not really much fighting during the Second World War in Korea. And all their industry was in shape. And they were actually, you know, okay. But then obviously the Korean Wars happened and that devastated everything. And that was also the fight between the North and the South, communism, and then the West. So there's a checkered history there. And the Japanese really, you know, even until relatively recently, until I think it was the late 90s, Japanese popular culture was banned in Korea. Because there was just didn't want that influence, and vice versa. And there's still always that tension. But there's a very good foreign minister now in Korea called Jin Park, who actually taught me at Newcastle University, and he taught me Japanese. He actually taught me Japanese politics, and so he's an absolute star. He's fluent in Japanese. Obviously, he's Korean. His English is fantastic. He's a Harvard scholar, Oxford scholar, I think he was, and you know he's doing great work now in getting things, I think, one or more even keel. But yeah, the history between the two countries is fascinating. But what they say about Japan, it's quite interesting, is that Japan is an island nation whose neighbours don't really like it. It's also a monarchy, has quite a separate identity and sees themselves as a little bit perhaps superior to everyone else. And that's, the analogies to the UK are quite strong in that. So, there's a lot of this theory about it. So it's what it is to be an island nation, that you are a little bit separate from everybody else and perhaps, you know, have a more difficult relationship with your neighbours because you can. So, yeah, there's a lot of analogies there.
Well, at least you can advise them, you know, against their own version of Brexit, whatever that might be. But
well, not even started down.
But it is fascinating, isn't it, the Japanese culture, because it is a very traditional culture, from what I understand, I mean, as are many countries in that region. But Japan has significantly sort of punched above its weight for its size and location and island status. And if you look at the technology that they have, you know, bullet trains and the rest, it's a fascinating country that has been very capable of determining its own destiny.
Yeah, I think they are. Remarkable people, but at the same time, what you've seen in Japan is what you've seen in China, which is urbanization and the different times that happens. So for Japan, I think most of they're already quite an urban population, but this turning into the focus on cities, people moving from the villages to the cities. And for the Japanese, that happened in the 60s, 70s as they were growing after the Second World War. For the Chinese, as you know, that happened in the 80s, 90s, and even happening now still. So, you know, there's this, and this is where people start gaining wealth, you start seeing building, and the whole thing kind of self-perpetuating. But what the Japanese did, and are still doing, which was very clever, was looking to the rest of the world as well. And their trading companies, which are the main businesses in the center of all business in Japan, are really just that. They trade. And Japanese have always been great traders. And the remarkable thing is, as you said, is they have no raw materials, really. So they're trading, you know, more electronic goods, more high-value goods. And to have turned that country around within my, you know, my lifetime and a bit from, you know, absolute devastation. It's quite remarkable. But they're quite a united people. They're very much a valuable society. They know that their population is diminishing, but they haven't yet taken the step of embracing immigration because I think they're worried what impact that will have on Japanese society. So, yeah, it's an interesting time for them at the moment, but I'm sure they'll get through it.
Going back to you, so you then decided at some point that you would become a lawyer, and I don't know what it was that flipped that, but if and perhaps you can say, but I going through your history, and you'd only been qualified like 3-4 years when you're involved in opening an office for Dentons in Tokyo, and I was looking at that and thinking, what was it like to be a junior lawyer? And there you are opening an office.
Yeah, I mean, I was already at Dentons and they had an office in Tokyo and they were due to merge with a firm called Wild Sap. I don't
remember that. Yeah, I remember. Yeah, I do, yeah.
And the only place where Wild Sap and Dentons, other than London, had offices in the same city was Tokyo. And so there was a real thing about whether we merge with them in Tokyo. And my then boss and current partner, Steve Lewis, decided that we'd be better off as a team if we moved to Herbert Smith in Tokyo and built Herbert Smith in Tokyo. That's who we built. And so, yeah, doing that was quite interesting because you literally just pick yourself up and walk out, and then the next day you're in a new office and you're building it from scratch and you're importing a new brand. I mean, it was a good brand and it was quite well known in Japan, but actually you are starting from scratch. I think that was very, very interesting how they did that. And I think the first thing they did was come and put all our fees up, which was quite interesting because their brand fees were higher than the previous firm's fees. So, that's the first thing they did.
It's not often you can do that in your career, is it? Just up your fees all the time.
Well, yeah, I was only very junior, so it wasn't my decision. But, you know, yeah, no, but that was because just to get the fee rates equivalent to the rest of the international fee rates for then Herbert Smith.
Were you by then already fluent in Japanese?
Yeah, I learned Japanese at university. So that's when I switched courses at university.
So you spent the year abroad. So how long did it take you? Because, you know, there are lots of stories about, you know, how long it takes you to learn such a complex language.
Well, there are different levels. There's the speaking part, which if you're not... It's very interesting because I found that if you're willing to give it a go and not worry too much about grammar, build your vocabulary, then you can speak pretty quickly. If you want to then push it and get the grammar correct, that takes obviously a little bit longer. And then the reading of it is a lifetime occupation because obviously that's very complex, but not impossible by any means. And people do it quite easily. But if you don't keep it up, then you can lose it. So whilst I probably knew thousands of kanji, what they call kanji, which is the Chinese characters that the Japanese use, at some stage you do kind of forget about them, which is one of the reasons I've heard why the Japanese invented the word processor, because you can just put in phonetics and it comes up with the choice of characters based on that phonetic, and you can then easily choose. But to then write it is very independently, is quite hard, but to choose it on a screen is a lot easier. So it's not that hard, you know, especially if you're talking about the vocabulary. And Japanese adopt a lot of Western words as well. So coffee is copy, you know, the schedule is schedule, you know, there's a lot of other words, and, you know, they have a smattering of English as well. So you can get by, it's about just having a go at it.
And okay, you mentioned coffee, so that you can tell. Do the Japanese drink hot or cold coffee?
Both. And they both come in cans, even the hot coffee comes in cans.
In the can, okay.
You get it from vending machines in cans, hot.
This is going to be a shock, because the first time I was in Korea at a conference, I went into, you know, a Starbucks, and it should be said that I've never been to a country in the world with as many coffee shops as Korea. I mean, just unbelievable. And I went in and ordered a coffee, and they gave it to me, and I walked out and I sort of took a sip. And it was cold, and I went back in, and they all had amazing English, and I went back in and said, it's cold, and then spent several minutes with this complete mismatch of culture and language, trying to explain to them that there was something wrong with my coffee because it was cold. And they were looking at me as the moron I clearly was, because they have cold coffee. And he was like, well, it's meant to be cold. And I was saying, it's cold. And they're saying, yes. I said, but I don't want it cold. And after some, you know, we managed to get there. Yeah, you could produce hot coffee. And then after that, I learned I had to actually ask for hot coffee. But this concept that they'll drink year-round cold coffee, it's just like, it was so funny.
Well, my one that I had that for that was when, remember ER, the TV show ER?
Yeah.
You know, did a live episode on the East Coast, followed by a live episode on the West Coast. And they produced it into two videos. And I remember going to the video shop and hiring this ER set, taking it home, watching it, and realizing they're exactly the same, and going back and complaining. And the guy couldn't explain to me, and I couldn't explain in Japanese at that stage exactly what was going on, because just the concept of having two things exactly the same and watching both was just bizarre. But he was right, I was wrong, but he still gave me my money back.
Presumably because you're no longer immersed in Japanese. Are people surprised when you're in Japan and opportunity arises? I presume you've still got enough, you know, spoken Japanese. I don't know what your current, where you'd class yourself in.
Yeah. I mean, I was speaking the other day at an event and somebody was saying, oh, you speak Japanese. That's remarkable. And it's, people have been saying that for 30 years. And I just say, it's not remarkable. I just learned it. And it's like people learn Spanish or Arabic or other languages. It's just people seem to think it's like an impossible language, and it isn't. You know, I still keep it, but I still use it. I still watch Japanese films. There's a lot on Netflix, for example. They are subtitled, but you can just watch them in Japanese. So then when I'm on an airplane, I'll watch a Japanese movie. There's a book, I can't remember what it's called now, but it discusses each different culture and the strengths and weaknesses of each culture, what you do in a business situation. And I went to the English section, and it said that generally people from the south of England don't speak a second language, but the people from the north do. So I'm going to get that framed somewhere. Just you need to have a mask, you know. Oh, you speak a second language, but you're from Yorkshire.
I think what they mean, Nick, is that people from the north speak northern, but they can also speak to southerners, you see. So I think that's the dual language. It you talk about language. That's an interesting issue, because I think it's something that is going to be an increasingly major issue in the law. And I'm interested in your take, because my sons are 22, my daughter's 27. They all speak a variety of languages, but our languages are focused on, you know, French, German, Spanish. And I'm not sure, you know, treading on thin ice, I'm not sure how well languages are taught at school, and then you get to university. About a year or so ago, I did have a Japanese, we're acting for a Japanese law firm, and they wanted to see if there was Japanese speaking counsel, because it would have been very helpful for their client. And so I trawled through construction and engineering, and there were one or two counsel who had on their CV listed Japanese. And I got in touch with their clerks, and it was interesting that none of them could speak Japanese. And I spoke to one counsel, and he said, oh, no, I could order a drink, but, you know, that's as far as my Japanese goes. And I said, well, you know, with all due politeness, I think you should take it off your CV on Chambers, because you can't. So nobody, I couldn't find a single counsel in London, in our sort of area, that speaks Japanese. And it did start me wondering, if you had a client, obvious recent years, Russian, but Chinese, I think Chinese probably wouldn't be as difficult, or Korean, how many counsel or lawyers, in the generic, really speak a foreign language to the degree that you could converse with clients? And if the UK wants to remain an international force, surely this is something that, you know, should be encouraged and thought about.
I decided at a young age that I was going to do Europe later on in life, and I was going to do Asia first, and that seemed to be more interesting, more exotic. And you're right, I mean, I sat down with a doctor about 5 years ago, and he said his daughter was trying to get into law firms, and she wasn't having much success. So she was having 6 months off and was going to Vietnam. And I said, well, why doesn't she learn the language? He said, but it's only 6 months. I said, yeah, but in 6 months you can learn a lot. And also you'll get to have a better experience of being there. And also you'll get to know how they think, because language tracks how people think and their behavior and their attitude. And so you'll be able to understand them better. And I spoke to her a year later, and she'd got a job. And she didn't say that she could speak fluent Vietnamese. She was very honest, apparently, but they were just so intrigued that she'd gone to that trouble. And it made a difference. It made her CV stand out. So any student who says to me now, what's the key to getting a job in a law firm, I say, if you've got an international law firm, I say learn a language to whatever level, just learn it, yeah, and keep learning it. It's a lifetime experience.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I think it should be something we encourage more, because I think the days of the English arrogance of speaking slowly and more loudly, being our form of communication, are gone, and we need to demonstrate that true internationalism.
And also this generation of young people, it's very difficult unless you're an EU citizen to work in the EU. I mean, I was in Brussels last week, I was in Vienna the week before that, and I was in Greece last year. All have the same story, is that they're no longer hiring trainees. Well, they can't get them in on visas if that's their EU nationals, because they've got no right to work. And they've got to bring them in. You've got to apply like 6 months in advance. You've got to put them on an entrepreneur's visa or something like that, in Belgium in particular. So they're not doing it anymore. That's really, really sad. And I think that's not going to change very quickly. So I would recommend people do, non-European languages if they want to get on internationally, because Europe's pretty closed at the moment. That won't stay like that forever.
It's a major problem. My daughter, when she was dancing, doing her training, she spent pretty much a year in Budapest, a year in Florence, and a year in Harlem. And while she was in each country, she's now pretty fluent in Italian, but she went to Hungarian evening classes, and she learnt enough that she taught me on one of the trips I was at merely to say please and thank you. And she taught me to say, and I wrote it down, and she gave it to me phonetically, because I am appalling with language, how to say thank you very much, that was really kind of you, which I said to the taxi driver when he took me to the airport. He got out of the car and hugged me, because I just made that effort, and so few people. And she learnt a bit of Dutch, but you're quite right, those opportunities are closed in this sort of the Erasmus programme and things like that, and it's very restrictive now on young people, because those are the countries on our doorstep, but now they need to sort of widen the horizon, isn't it, and look at places like Japan and Far East Korea, and because there are huge opportunities. Those countries are still growing, aren't they?
Well, that's what the growth's going to be. There's a lot of urbanisation to happen in a lot of those countries. I mean, I can't remember the exact population of Indonesia, but it's about 280 million. There's a lot of people.
Oh, I mean, and the countries are huge. I've been Korea. Last time I was there last year, I took the bullet train down to Busan, and all the way down there are new sort of towns and cities being built. And you see, it's not just one or two; they're building 20 or 30 skyscraper blocks at a time. I mean, you say across that whole region, it's enormous. But I don't want to get too tracked with countries. You are president. You are the president, which I like. I like the fact that it's the president of the Law Society. What was it that encouraged you or interested you to start being involved? Because becoming president has not been a journey of a couple of years. I've known you a reasonably long time, and this is something that you've been engaged with from local law societies through. So what was it, a sense of service or just interest, or did someone say, Nick, I want you to be on that committee?
Yeah, it was the latter, actually. it was the regional representative for Yorkshire when we had regional representatives. She said, there's council elections coming up. Why don't you stand? I think you'd be good at it. And I was like, okay, that's very kind. What's council? You know, I had no idea what it was. And I stood, I won. And I remember pitching up here, still not really understanding what council was, having never, like many people, having never been in this building since I was a trainee or newly qualified. And sitting in council, and then just with council's 100 people, roughly. And at that time, they were debating a certain project that had gone wrong, where they'd spent a lot of money. And it was just interesting. One, that I didn't know anything about any of this stuff that was going on, you know, notionally on my behalf as one of a member of the profession and as a member of the Law Society. And two, it was just interesting, the dynamics of the people play, how it all worked. And then you worked out that actually there was this role called president and what the president did. And I just thought that sounds very interesting. But also, you then get into it and you think, well, decisions are made by people who turn up. And so I decided to keep turning up. And then I got more and more involved. And I thought, well, why don't I run for, well, you run for deputy vice president, and then you do that for a year, and then you're automatically vice president, and then automatically president after that. So there's always a queue of people behind you snapping at your heels as president. So I kind of fell into it, but once I was in it, I kind of just, it is a very interesting role.
And is it difficult, bearing in mind that, as you say, you have a long intro, but then you've become president, and it must be going very quickly?
It is. Some days it goes slower. I'll be honest. It depends. And the thing that surprised me about it is overnight you become a public figure. You know, it's literally overnight. You get the run-up, but it's not until you wear the badge. It's not about me, Nick Emerson. It's the badge, the president. And you do become a public figure. And what I mean by that is you're in the papers, who's who. There's that kind of element of it. But also you get then to meet very interesting people in the judiciary, at the top of the judiciary. You meet top politicians. You meet people in cities of our country who are the leaders of those cities. Then you also internationally as well, you get a lot of openness. For example, we were in front of the commission last week in Brussels, which the first time we'd got in front of the commission since Brexit. And that's because the president was in Brussels. So, yeah, it's a role. And it's an interesting role, and I'm a custodian of it for 1 year, and I will pass it on. 1 year is enough, but yeah, it's an interesting. It's far more involved than I thought it would be. It's a very active role rather than a passive one, if that makes sense.
And how did you decide on what were going to be your visions, your goals for the year?
Well, I've talked to past presidents, and you either have one specific goal that you then push, or you have a general agenda that you then move with events. And so I went with the latter, because there's a lot going on now in the profession. And it would help me then frame that. So for me, I just looked at my own experience and what I thought was important to me, but also to the profession. So the value of the profession globally, I think, just in terms of the work that we all do internationally from wherever we are in the UK or even overseas, and the value that brings to the profession. Because I spoke to government ministers, again, in the run-up, and they were kind of, well, you just facilitate. You're just standing behind the clients. It's the clients who make the decisions. You just help them. And you're like, oi, oi, actually, we are an industry in ourselves. You don't use the word industry. You don't use the word sector very often. But we contribute, I think it was 60 billion to the UK economy. We employ 550,000 people, which is 1.5% of the population. We're on every high street, in every town, every city, in this country and globally. So, and I think government get that now. They get that we're actually an industrial powerhouse, an industrial, you know, a success story, an absolute, you know, service industry success story, internationally as well as nationally. But also at the same time, we are lawyers. We protect the rule of law. We enhance access to justice. We contribute to society, and that's, you know, it's a pretty cool job when you think about it.
Yeah, and you're right. There's been some very interesting studies in the last couple of years talking about the value of the profession, the industry, to the economy as a whole. And as you say, it's about 60 billion. It's way more than people have previously given because of the areas. So Can you enlarge a little bit on, because I know you looked at a sort of international as a part of your vision, but also community. Can you talk a little bit about more about those?
Well, in my career, I've worked in London, I've worked overseas in Japan and China, but I've also worked obviously in Leeds, and that's why I know you from, Bill, as well. And I think I call it my triangle, and it's very important that all parts of that triangle are focused on. And we do focus a lot on London, we do focus a lot internationally, but also we need to focus a lot on the regions and what's going on there, the great work that's going on there, the great lawyers that we've got there, and the fact that, you know, if you have law firms in Leeds, as we do, and there are other cities as well, Liverpool, etc., you're providing really good jobs locally to people, so they don't have to all flock to London and live the London life. They can actually stay usually in their home area, but it doesn't have to be, and really have good quality, decent jobs, doing good quality, decent work in a very nice environment. And that then, you know, boosts the cities that they're in. So yes, it's about that local connection, and also, you know, connection to local people and making sure that people can get access to justice. And it doesn't, not just on the commercial side, but on the criminal and civil legal aid side as well, and making sure we've got lawyers on the ground there who know their people. And that's very important, avoiding these legal aid deserts where we don't have any people at all. Yeah, I think lawyers, they contribute locally as well as nationally and internationally. I think it's very important to focus on that.
Yeah, and that commitment. And then also it is important. I think it's great that you are singing the praises of the profession, just from a very basic level, as you say, from the high street all the way up, because law firms represent a whole range of strata, don't they? A range of clients, from legal aid through to the large PLCs and the rest. And it's also therefore important that solicitors are appreciated at all those levels, isn't it?
You said the key word there, Bill. It's the word solicitor for me. It's not the law firms, because the law firms are important, but they're collections of solicitors. And obviously 26% of all solicitors work in-house now that we know of. It could be more than that. Certainly 26% is a minimum. And so for me, it's about brand solicitor. It's what it is to be a solicitor and what that means. You have a societal obligation being a solicitor because of your role in society and the privilege that you get for doing that. But you also have ethics and responsibilities as well, and all that's coming into play. And it's about what it means to be a solicitor, what it means to have that professional qualification, and what that means in terms of interacting, especially nowadays, with your client. And instead of, you know, your client dictating your advice, it's you giving your advice to your client, but at the same time having acknowledged your professional responsibilities, your responsibilities to the court, your responsibilities to society. And I think that is something that's very, very important. And we're seeing, for example, with what's coming out with the Post Office Horizon scandal, that, you know, if you confuse that and then just make your, not moral benchmark, but your benchmark as a solicitor, what your client wants, what makes your client happy, then that can be quite dangerous.
That's a very interesting point. And how do you see, so how, from your very elevated position, what do you think the health of the legal profession solicitors is, and what's your sort of prognosis over the next few years for the ongoing health?
Well, the rule of law is a constant fight, and so we have to continue to fight as solicitors for the rule of law in this country. What I mean by that is we have to fight for legal aid, we have to fight for decent courts, we have to fight for an ethical standard that we can all, you know, associate with very clearly. And I'm very confident in the solicitor profession. We are the dominant profession. We are well managed. We are well represented. We are well regulated, I think, ultimately. And we're also big. People are still very attracted to our profession. With the new SQE, more and more international people are taking that. So it's about 25% of people are now taking the SQE from overseas as a second qualification, usually. And I've already been practicing for a number of years. But that then helps the globalization of English law, the fact that we are a global law. We do have competitors. Obviously, we've always had competitors in New York. We have competitors in Singapore. But we're still dominant. We're still predominant. But we need to work on that and keep working on the rule of law in this country. The Post Office Horizon is an interesting one at the moment, as I just mentioned. But there's also other things going on that, you know, attacks on lawyers, et cetera, that we just need to focus on because, and be honest about, because we don't want to hide these things and say we're all perfect. We're not. And it's those imperfections and working on those imperfections that makes the rule of law stronger. So, yeah, I'm very, very excited about the future of being a solicitor. And I do really find that, you know, since the Law Society is no longer the regulator, it's now really found its groove in being the representative body and what that means. And, you know, being in this position of president, you can see firsthand the work that goes on to really make sure that, you know, the brand solicitor is kept tight and the rule of law is looked after.
And I think those are really important points. I talk to a lot of people about how important it is to be a solicitor. I like the fact, I know that you've talked about in other talks and presentations, the difference between just being an employee and being part of a profession, and the importance of our moral compass within that. And I think that we, you know, solicitors have just an incredibly important role in developing the, as you say, rule of law, but also representing this country in ways that a lot of people don't think about, because we are present in so many different places and in so many different contracts and negotiations. English law firms, English solicitors crop up and appear, and I think that's something that, again, we have to not take for granted, isn't it, and fight to maintain our share.
Yeah, I mean, as I said before, I've focused on the profession as an industry in itself. You're right, and it's right, going back to what the minister's initial view was, which we are actually facilitators of a lot of trade and a lot of business, and we help people out at difficult moments in their lives. We give them access to the state in terms of access to justice. We give them a lot of support, and that's at every level of society, in every town and every city. So, yeah, I mean, it's a remarkable profession. And what binds us all, when especially being in-house as well, is that we are solicitors first and foremost. And that has to mean something, and that has to be something special. And I think it is, and we keep working on that as well. And we're all individually, as I say to the newly qualified at the admission ceremony, you know, the actions of all of us reflect the actions of all of us, and we are solicitors, and we have to be very, very, we have to have integrity, and we have to have all those other qualities that are necessary.
Yeah, and I would say I've known quite a few presidents now over the years from my roles within the Law Society, but I do particularly like the themes that you have this year. I do think they're really, they've really struck a chord, and I think they're great themes. So sort of on rounding off, on a personal level, what are you excited about? You know, what things are you going to be doing over the next 6 months? What's going to excite you most? Travel, something? What's something new? Or
travel doesn't really excite me as much because it's not a holiday. Basically,
you're working
to dusk, working, and you a lot of people. You're very well briefed. There's about 420 people working with the Law Society, and you are very. They all do work to make sure you're properly briefed and you get A to B on time. So it's not so much travel. For me, I think it's the election that's coming up, and just what, we're not quite yet into the campaigning mode, but that's going to come. But it's this pre-election sort of very tense sort of movement now into, you know, is there going to be a change of government? If so, what will that look like? But for now, you know, we've at least got several months of the current government and what they're going to do and what their legacy is going to be. And I think it's just, you know, you talk about the presidency being for 1 year. Well, everybody's on a 1 year gig at the moment. Everybody's less than 1 year. And it's got a real nice, whilst that's very interesting in one respect, it's good in another because people are really on their game, they're top of their game. I don't see people giving up, walking away. I see people really just, you know, fighting for this year and fighting for justice. And I think that it's just going to be very, very interesting to see how it all pans out and what actually happens. I think it's just a very interesting time to be alive.
Yeah, we haven't. I mean, we haven't touched on any of the other issues. What about you going, finishing as president? Is that something that you have time to think about? Do you think about going back into practice your firm?
No, I'll definitely go back to work. I mean, the thing is that it's like, was it Caesar had so many whispering in his ear, you are mortal all the time. And I think having a one-year term, it makes you very mortal. And I say to people that if any stage I become presidential, just let me know, because, you know, there is that tendency to become a little bit, you know.
I can't imagine ever you ever becoming too presidential, Nick. I genuinely can't. You're a lovely guy, and I think you've worked, you know, incredibly hard to be where you are. And I think we've been very fortunate in the Law Society over recent years to have a more diverse, in all senses, a range of presidents. I think it's benefited the profession greatly.
Well, thank you for that. And I will be standing down as president at the end of October, in the middle of October. And also I'll be standing down as representative for Leeds. So there'll be a vacancy that will be coming up. So we do need to find somebody else to fill the Leeds.
Well, who could that possibly be? I have no idea. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's lovely to see you, if only on a screen. I look forward to seeing you in a few weeks' time in person.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you for joining me for today's Barton Legal podcast. Please make sure you follow the show in your podcast app to get new episodes as soon as they're released. We'll be tackling another important topic in this month's Barton Legal webinar, and you can register for free and watch back our previous webinars at bartonlegal.com. Why don't you connect with me on LinkedIn and follow Barton Legal to keep up to date with all the legal trends and news? I look forward to speaking to you again in the next Barton Legal podcast.